I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Friday marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It also marks 50 years since Walt Disney selected Central Florida for the home of his theme park, Walt Disney World. I'll speak to University of Central Florida history lecturer Jim Clark and Florida Today space reporter James Dean about the impact Kennedy had on the Space Coast and Disney's Central Florida decision. Also, Puerto Rico's Senate President Eduardo Batia was just selected to lead the National Hispanic Caucus of State Legislators here in the United States. 90.7's Amy Kiley spoke to Batia about Puerto Rico's relationship with the United States and Central Florida. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Jim Clark. Jim is a lecturer in history at the University of Central Florida. His latest book is called Orlando, Florida, A Brief History. Jim, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Also joining me by phone is James Dean. He's the space reporter from Florida Today. James, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
James, I want to start with you. President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. But just a week before that, he was in Florida. What was he doing there?
That's right. On November 16th, 1963, the president flew into Cape Canaveral, what is now Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, came up from his family's home in Palm Beach, and he received some briefings from NASA folks about the progress of the programs that were supposed to land men on the moon later in the decade. And he saw a rocket on its launch pad, flew over the area that was just starting to be developed into what we know now as Kennedy Space Center. Then he was flown out on the same helicopter out to a ship, a Navy ship, where he saw a missile launched from a submarine, and that wrapped up his visit.
Now, was this something he did regularly? How often did he come to visit Florida to check up on the space program or other issues in Florida?
Well, it was his third visit within a two-year period to Cape Canaveral, which, again, is where NASA's operations were based through that period of time. Kennedy Space Center, as I mentioned, was just starting to be built when he last came, mm-hmm. or what we think of as, you know, the key elements of Kennedy Space Center, the vehicle assembly building and the launch pads out here. So that's fairly frequent, I suppose, for as far as the record of presidential visits out here goes. I can't speak to Florida in general. I think perhaps Jim knows more about that, but indeed, it was evidence that he was keenly interested in this program that obviously was a subject of great national interest, the race to the moon, the space race with the Soviet Union, and he was checking up on its progress that day.
Well, I'm speaking to James Dean. He's a space reporter from Florida Today, and we're also joined in the studio by Jim Clark, a lecturer in history at the University of Central Florida. Now, Jim, November 22nd, 1963 was also a historic day for Central Florida in another way. What was Walt Disney doing in Central Florida?
It's an amazing thing that we think of this as the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, which, of course, is true. But most people don't realize that this is the date that changed Orlando forever. Walt Disney, on Wednesday, the 20th, flew into Tampa. He had narrowed down his search for a new attraction, to two cities, Ocala and Orlando. On Thursday, he drove up to Ocala. His family had lived in Lake County. He had been to Ocala before. He knew the town. And he also knew at the time, before the interstate highway system was completed, that Ocala had some of the best connecting roads in the country. So Ocala was really a serious contender for Disney World. The next day, on Friday, he got in his Gulfstream plane. He was a pilot, and he flew to Orlando. He looked down at where I-4 and the Turnpike intersect, and he pointed out the window and said, "That's it." Mm-hmm. And the decision was made that day to build Disney World here. Mary Dmitri, whose father owned the land, 12,400 acres, where the Magic Kingdom is situated, said that her father told her that Walt also pointed to a spot of land and said, "That's where we'll put Tom Sawyer's Island." Walt Disney then flies to New Orleans. Secrecy already becoming vital to him. On his way back to California, they stop to refuel the plane. When the plane lands in New Orleans, he is told that President Kennedy has been assassinated.
Why the level of secrecy around this?
Because of the land prices. They needed to put together a total of 26,000 acres. The Dimitri property was the core of it, 12,400 acres. But the other land was owned by dozens of people, and they needed to keep it secret or the land prices would have soared. And you would have ended up with little islands of land in the middle of the Disney property that they did not control. So they ended up paying an average of $200 an acre, which, of course, seems ridiculous. But remember, most of this was swampland. Most of it was considered worthless. Some people had some cows out there, but there was nothing there at the time.
I guess we're looking at two sort of very different operations, but two operations in terms of the space program and the Disney theme park, Walt Disney World, in Central Florida that have had a profound impact on this area. In some ways, though, when you look at how things have played out with the demise of the shuttle program, clearly Disney has come out the winner in terms of that operation is just growing and growing, whereas I guess the space program is in a little bit of flux at the moment.
It certainly is, and I think Jamie can talk to this. The fact is that Johnson had been the big pusher. Lyndon Johnson had been the big pusher for the space program going back to his Senate days. He was the one, in fact, who came up with the phrase missile gap, which was so important in the 1960 election. And so Kennedy had turned to Johnson, who put the Space Center in his home state of Texas in Houston. So I think Jamie can talk to this. The economy of Titusville and that area has been kind of up and down.
Mm-hmm. Well, James Dean, space reporter from Florida Today, how do you see things playing out from here? Clearly, there are some who would say that the space program isn't where it needs to be, and they would like to see more investment out on the Space Coast in what NASA had already sort of built up there. Do you think 10, 20, 30 years from now, we will see a vibrant space economy out in that area of Florida?
There's certainly potential for that. As Jim noted, over the past 50 years, essentially, we've had sort of a boom-bust role in these programs where we're the launch site. So when they stopped launching, when the Apollo program was shut down, we had an extended gap. In the 70s, before the shuttle program came up, huge numbers of people laid off as the Apollo program abruptly was ended. And then, obviously, again, in the last couple of years, we saw thousands of contractors laid off as the shuttle came to an end. And so, obviously, we're in this transition now. And, again, it's interesting to see, or will be interesting to see, how we, if we are able to adapt all of this infrastructure that was put in place, was starting to be put in place during the Kennedy administration for the specific purpose of getting men to the moon to meet the mandate that he gave. And now we don't have a compelling geopolitical situation, a space race like we did then to support big budgets for space exploration. So we're trying to adapt our people's expectations for what the space program should be that were set back then. We're trying to adapt the infrastructure that was built to serve that goal back then. And what they're doing is opening up the center, essentially, to not just be a government-run spaceport, but trying to transform it into a multi-user spaceport.
Just on the name of Kennedy Space Center, too, obviously, it wasn't always that way. Would you just explain how it came to become Kennedy Space Center? And I guess how JFK has, in that way, really cemented his place in the legacy of the United States space exploration program.
That's right. At the time that he visited for the last time, NASA, this facility was known as the Launch Operations Center. It just the year before, in 1962, had gone from a field center that was under the management of the Goddard Space Flight Center up in Maryland to its own independent center, but it was known as the Launch Operations Center. a week after Kennedy's assassination, November 29th, Lyndon Johnson signed an executive order number 11129 that renamed the Center for Kennedy. It was apparently caused a little bit of confusion, actually, at the time, because it kind of lumped together the NASA operations and the Air Force operations. And ultimately, the actual landmass of Cape Canaveral was renamed Cape Kennedy as well. That was a decision that was reversed 10 years later. Pardon me, in 1973, when the Florida legislature decided that the historical significance of the Cape Canaveral name, dating to the Spanish explorers, was something that should be preserved. So we ended up with Kennedy Space Center, as you said, cementing Kennedy's tie to the space program and this community. The Air Force operations ultimately returned to having Cape Canaveral associated with their name as well, Cape Canaveral Air Force Station today. And the city of Cape Canaveral never did change its name. It was being incorporated in that same year, earlier in 1963, and there was debate about whether to change the name, but they stuck with Cape Canaveral.
Now, you said JFK was, in his own mind, as he came away from that visit to the Kennedy Space Center or to Titusville and Cape Canaveral at the time, he was reassured that the space program was on track and confident that things would proceed as he wanted them to. What about the folks who worked there? Were they inspired by that visit?
I believe they were. Of course, nobody knew what was about to transpire, it was his third visit, and I suspect they were really just focused on getting this fast-growing, ambitious program off the ground.
Jim Clark, do you get the impression, or what do you think about the influence of Kennedy's assassination on the space program, if at all? Do you think it had any impact on the way things progressed over the next 6-7 years?
I think so. Remember that Orlando was a huge beneficiary from the space program. You could argue that today Orlando is a bigger beneficiary than Titusville is. In 1957, Glenn Martin came here and built his huge plant out there, eventually employing 8,000 people, and it drew other military contractors who were interested in the space program. Their initial contracts would be the space program.
And we're talking about Lockheed Martin here?
Yes, now it's Lockheed Martin, which still employs huge numbers of people and is one of the legs of our economy here. The reason they came here was our fantastic airport. The leaders of the city had made a deal with the Air Force to jointly use the Air Force base as our airport, which was unheard of at the time. So we had the airport, and people like Glenn Martin saw that, knew they'd be flying in and out, their employees. And so they located here, not in Brevard County. So we ended up with thousands and thousands of permanent jobs, which were, before tourism, the main fuel of our economy. At the same time, remember, 1963 is also important because it's the year we get the University of Central Florida, what's now UCF, mm-hmm. back then Florida Tech. So by 1963, the three legs of our economy are set.
What do you think about, Jim Clark, what do you think about the Space Coast? Do you feel like there's an opportunity they've missed there in terms of how they've gone about trying to move the region forward after the space program?
It's strange, and a number of people have asked about this over the years. At one point, Titusville, Florida had the greatest percentage of per capita PhDs in the country. And the question is why this didn't develop into a Silicon Valley, a center for research. I think part of it was because a number of companies like Lockheed Martin had located here in Orlando. But the question becomes, why didn't Titusville take off as a major city?
James Dean, I wonder if I might ask you now, obviously this week there's that big launch of the Maven spacecraft to Mars. There's quite a bit of interest in that. But do you feel that NASA has a harder job now of trying to generate interest and down the track political interest in exploration missions like this and in the future?
It seems to be having a difficult time. The reality is, as neat as many people think launching an orbiter or certainly a rover to Mars is, the crowds in terms of what we see around here for launches, they're not what they were for, say, a shuttle launch. So the reality is that it's the human spaceflight missions that draw the big crowds.
I've been speaking to James Dean. He's a space reporter from Florida Today. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us, James.
Thanks for having me.
And I've also been joined in the studio by Jim Clark. He's a lecturer in history at the University of Central Florida. His latest book is Orlando, Florida, A Brief History. Jim, thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Up next, a conversation with Puerto Rico Senate President Eduardo Batia. Eduardo Batia is Puerto Rico's Senate President. He's also the newly elected leader of the National Hispanic Caucus of State Legislators here in the U.S. Recently, 90.7's Amy Kiley sat down with Batia. He started the conversation by explaining the relationship between Central Florida and Puerto Rico.
Well, there's a great connection, and I think the connection dates back not only for Orlando, but for Florida. The governor of Puerto Rico, the first governor of Puerto Rico, discovered Florida and named Florida. It was 500 years ago. The year was 1513. And Juan Ponce de León, on Easter Day, in Spanish we call it Pascua Florida. So Pascua Florida became Florida, and that's the way the name of the state of Florida. Now, in terms of more recent years, there are many Puerto Ricans. There are close to 1 million Puerto Ricans who have moved to Central Florida. I think after the beginning of Disney World, a number of Puerto Ricans started working there, and voice and word got around, and a number of good jobs were opened, and many families have moved to Central Florida, and they are about to surpass New York as the number one place for folks who have left Puerto Rico and are of Puerto Rican descent.
What are the economic ramifications for both Puerto Rico and Central Florida that stem from this relationship?
I think what we have to realize is that there are about 8 million Puerto Ricans, and about 3.5 live in Puerto Rico. The rest live outside of Puerto Rico. So what are the ramifications? There are some great opportunities for both sides. I think it's not a time for us to say, why did you leave? To basically say you left or you are outside Puerto Rico. What a great opportunity for us to keep connected. And the question is, how do we keep those connections? I come to Central Florida a lot. My brother lives in Gainesville. So I have family here. I have friends here. And I try to keep that sense of community and familia that we all cherish and that we all like so much. So there are some commercial ties. There are some social ties. There are some religious elements involved. And more than anything else, there are some very deep political implications. I would say that Florida, if the Puerto Ricans vote for either en masse for either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, Florida will no longer be a swing state if the Puerto Ricans vote as a bloc. I'm not sure how they're going to vote, and I'm not sure they do vote as a bloc, but I am sure that if they do vote as a bloc, Florida will stop being a swing state.
Your party defines the relationship between the U.S. as having a common market. What does that mean in economic terms?
Well, a common market is nothing, no different than the situation in Michigan or New York or Ohio. You buy goods and products without any limitations from different states, and Puerto Rico is part of the common market of the United States. We don't have to go through any special procedure. We don't have quotas in terms of if you produce salmon in Alaska and you want to bring it to Puerto Rico, you bring it to Puerto Rico. If we produce coffee in Puerto Rico and we want to take it to Alaska, we have free trade. And I think in terms of the newly discovered free trade agreements, Puerto Rico and the United States have had those free trade agreements for the longest time.
A lot of companies in Orlando have recruited from Puerto Rico. Do you think that causes a kind of brain drain where very educated, qualified bilingual speakers come here?
Yeah, I have heard that term, the brain drain, and a lot of people use it and kind of get really, there's a little hysteria about brain drain. I have no problems with brain drain. I think there are many professionals in Puerto Rico who are leaving the island and coming back, learning more. I think Puerto Rico is an island. The definition of an island is that you're isolated. The word isolated comes from island. And I think to the extent that many Puerto Ricans leave for a couple of years and come back and learn and can, you know, globalize Puerto Rico and can, you know, go out there, I'm sure Queen Elizabeth, Queen Isabel in Spain was not worried that Christopher Columbus had a brain drain. And in that sense, you know, it's important that we look at it as not as a loss, but as an opportunity.
So a lot of employers in this area value Puerto Rican workers because bilingual, educated, and can work here legally. If immigration reform goes through and more people who speak Spanish are able to work here legally, do you think that'll cause a competition for jobs to increase for the Puerto Rican community?
I think the more languages you speak, the better it is. I think, you know, Florida is becoming a center of economic activity precisely because, other, you know, more than any other state in the union, it can not only speak Spanish and English, it's already moving forward in terms of my nieces and nephews who live here in Florida now have to learn Mandarin. So I think people in Florida are realizing that, you know, we have to act locally, but you have to think globally. That old axiom is finally coming through in Florida. So I am very fond of Floridians, and I think Floridians are doing the right thing.
But if immigration reform does go through and suddenly more people who can speak Spanish are able to work here, do you think that competition for jobs will increase and that it'll be harder for Puerto Ricans to find those bilingual jobs here?
I encourage immigration reform. I'm all for immigration reform. I think that immigrants are already here. I think immigration reform is not about bringing more people. It's about legalizing those who are already working here. So in a way, I don't see that as a threat. I see that as an opportunity. And I see that not only do we have to look at this from an economic standpoint, but from a human rights standpoint. I mean, these are Americans who have lived here, in their children were born in this country, and they have every single right to be citizens, and they're paying taxes, and they should pay taxes, and they should be incorporated into the mainstream of America.
I know your party advocates for maintaining the Commonwealth status. Why that as opposed to statehood?
My party is really about the middle class. It's really about developing. We have 50% of the people in Puerto Rico who are poor, and we want to create a middle class. We want to get them out of poverty. If you can convince me that statehood is the way to go, I'll do it. If you can convince me that independence is the way to go, I'll do it. If you can convince me that Commonwealth is the way to go. The reason why most people are not for statehood in terms of, you know, the way I see it, it has a lot to do with taxes. I mean, we are not paying federal taxes. And the question is whether we should be paying federal taxes. And the answer is not now. It will create a great economic dislocation in Puerto Rico. So to the extent that we can have a very strong bond with the United States and at the same time keep our eyes on the prize, which is create a middle class, I think we need to find that sort of balance between the two. Statehood could be an independence. Both could be great ideas. The question is the execution. How do you do it? How do you keep a middle class growing with enormous federal taxes that you don't have right now?
Your assistant told me that you're working on an energy policy. Can you explain what you're doing? And Florida certainly has proximity and energy resources. Would there be any exporting or importing?
Well, I hope so. I hope Florida gets involved in the area of energy with Puerto Rico. We can learn a lot from Florida. Florida has it's a great model because you have a great combination. You have a portfolio of several, you know, different fuels for to create energy. You have solar, you have wind, you have gas, you have oil, you have nuclear. Florida is quite the example to follow. Now, Puerto Rico is an island, so the question then becomes, how can you replicate some of what Florida is doing? The problem right now, to define the problem, Puerto Ricans pay about 26 to 27 cents per kilowatt hour. In Florida, it's about 6 cents per kilowatt hour. So we're paying four times as much as Floridians are when you have a much poorer economy than Florida. Now, we have a monopoly. We have the state owns only the sole electric power company. So my argument is, It's owned by the state. The state doesn't have the fiscal resources to modernize its plant. We have energy. Our energy plants were built in the 1950s and 60s. So the question is, should we retrofit a car that was built in the 50s so that it gives us between 9, it will give us now 10 miles per gallon, or do we retrofit it, or we stop retrofitting old plants and buy a new one? And if we're going to buy a new one, my energy plan in Puerto Rico is we have to do public-private partnerships. And I have been advocating for those partnerships for a while.
Today at this conference, some activities this afternoon are focusing on education and youth. And here in the States, the Spanish-speaking population is very young. Right. What is the importance of focusing on that young sector?
One of every three Americans in public, in grades, kindergarten to 12th grade, in elementary, secondary school, are Latinos. One of every three. So 33% of our future right now is on, depends on the education that we give to those children. Latinos, whether they like it or not, or whether we like it or not, we have to get ready to lead the country. We have to get ready to lead from in every aspect, not only from the political perspective, from the business perspective, from the academic perspective, from the judiciary perspective. I mean, we have to have Latino leaders throughout the nation. And the best way to do it is starting kindergarten. You know, kids who are Latinos have to learn from kindergarten on that they will lead the nation one day. And they have to do it. They have to get ready. And so this forum that we have on education and others that we have had during the National Hispanic Caucus of State Legislatures is really to focus on, put a magnifying glass on the reality of America. And, we're not going to get anything as a gift. We have to fight for what we have. However, there is one thing that will come whether we like it or not, and that is the petition by the people of the United States to have a Latino, have Latino leaders throughout our states. And I think it's important that we're ready and that we're educated, and that we know when our time comes to be the captain of the ship, that we know where we're going, and we certainly don't sink.
Anything else you want to add about the tie between Florida and Puerto Rico? Maybe what you want to see in the future?
Yeah, there's something that I have to say in terms of the Jacksonville port, the Port of Jacksonville. 50% of its cargo, 50% of the economic movement of Jacksonville, goes to Puerto Rico. So in a way, there's a very strong economic link between Puerto Rico and Jacksonville. And again, I think, now that the economy of Puerto Rico is going through a difficult period, I think it's a good time for our business partners to realize that, it's helping us strengthen the Puerto Rican economy and helping us strengthen the future of Puerto Rico helps all of us. I think it's a win-win situation. Florida is a natural, Miami, Orlando, Jacksonville, they are the natural partners for Puerto Rico. And to the extent that we can learn from that, to the extent that we can participate with Florida, to the extent that we get to know each other better, and to the extent that Puerto Ricans participate more in the political process in Florida, we're going to have a better future.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was 90.7's Amy Kiley speaking with Puerto Rico's Senate President Eduardo Batia. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.